Voy a ponerme la vacuna Prevnar 20 porque estoy en riesgo de contraer la neumonía neumocócica,
la cual pudiera llevarme al hospital. Así que preguntaré sobre Prevnar 20.
65 años o más, puedes estar en mayor riesgo de contraer la neumonía neumocócica. Pregunta a tu médico o farmacéutico acerca de vacunarte con Prevnar 20. Vacuna conjugada antineumocócica 20 valente. Una vacuna de Pfizer que puede ayudar a proteger contra la neumonía neumocócica con una sola dosis. Prevnar 20 está aprobada para adultos para ayudar a prevenir infecciones contra 20 cepas de la bacteria que causa la neumonía neumocócica. La aprobación continua puede depender de un estudio de apoyo. No uses Prevnar 20 si has tenido una reacción alérgica grave a la vacuna o a sus componentes. Adultos con sistemas inmunitarios debilitados pueden tener una respuesta reducida a la vacuna. El efecto secundario más reportado fue dolor en el área de la inyección. Para más efectos secundarios comunes e información completa de prescripción, llama al 1-855-213-2138 o visita Prevnar20enespañol.com. Pregunta a tu médico o farmacéutico sobre Prevnar 20.
It is Ryan here, and I have a question for you. What do you do when you win? Like, are you a fist pumper, a woohooer, a hand clapper, a high fiver? I kind of like the high five, but if you want to hone in on those winning moves, check out Chumba Casino. At chumbacasino.com, choose from hundreds of social casino style games for your chance to redeem serious cash prizes. There are new game releases weekly, plus free daily bonuses. So don't wait. Start having the most fun ever at chumbacasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions 18 plus.
Well, hello, everybody, and welcome to Talk Nerdy. Today is Monday, March 29th, 2021, and I'm the host of the show, Cara Santa Maria, and I just want to start out by giving you a great big thank you. Thank you for helping keep Talk Nerdy 100% free to download for anybody who wants to do so. Thank you for sharing the love and the support on social media by rating and reviewing the show on Google Podcasts and Apple Podcasts and all the different places that you get the show. And especially thank you to my top patrons this week. If you would like to support the show financially, you can visit patreon.com/talknerdy. This week, I want to give a shout out to Mary Neva, Michael Gaucher, Brian Holden, Christopher Pitts, Daniel Lang, David J.E. Smith, Dudas Infinitas, June Sapara, Leonard Prince, Pasquale Gelati, Pedro M. Rosario Barbosa, Scott Sanders, Ulrika Hageman, Elise Christie, and Robert Christ. Thank you so, so, so much. All right, let's talk about this week's episode. I had the absolute honor to have a conversation with Dr. Rita Colwell. So Dr. Colwell is a world-renowned and incredibly accomplished scientist, actually a microbiologist. She was the first woman to lead the National Science Foundation. Her research was instrumental in helping understand the nature of cholera, helping understand the nature of anthrax. She's published over 800 journal articles. She's written 19 books. She's won a ton of awards. And she's still working, still publishing. At the age of 86, she is a distinguished professor at both the University of Maryland and Johns Hopkins University's Bloomberg School of Public Health. When you hear women like me, women working in STEM fields, mention standing on the shoulders of giants, this is who we're talking about. So without any further ado, the author of A Lab of One's Own, One Woman's Personal Journey Through Sexism in Science, here she is, Dr. Rita Colwell. Well, Rita, thank you so much for joining me today.
It's a pleasure to be here, and I'm delighted to have an opportunity to talk with you.
Yeah, so we are talking about your new book, A Lab of One's Own, One Woman's Personal Journey Through Sexism in Science. The book's now been out for a few months, so I'm probably hitting you sort of on the tail end or even after your initial kind of book tour, if you want to call it that, during COVID. What has the experience been like for you so far?
It's been terrific. The reception has been amazing, particularly from, not unexpectedly, from women's groups, but also from scientific organizations as well. So I've been speaking to probably three or four lectures a week. which has been fun.
Yeah, that's a lot. And I'm sure that it's been keeping you a bit busy. Are you tired from all of that lecturing?
Not really, because it's kind of exhilarating talking to people who really care about the topic and want to know something about it. The questions have been very good. So I've been pleased, really.
Yeah. You know, I think it's so important to have a conversation about the issues around sexism, the issues around sort of having to break through some of these ceilings, and even the continued struggle of young people today within STEM fields. But I think it's important to hear from one of the people that I often say, like, we're standing on the shoulders of giants. I know my battle is uphill, but I can't imagine, well, I can now, what the experience must have been like for you. So first, I want to thank you for paving the way, but also for sharing that experience for us, because I think so often we kind of hear about it secondhand or have to imagine what it was like. Most of the people writing in this space are significantly younger.
Well, I started the book 5 years ago when it wasn't, it was pre-Me Too.
Right.
I was rather reluctant. In fact, I really didn't start out to write a book about sexism in science. It was more or less what my co-author thought was very intriguing, because as we were writing the book, she was unearthing published descriptions of other women's difficulties, and it seemed so similar to what I was experiencing or had experienced. So it kind of morphed into sexism in science. But I really am happiest, quite honestly, with the chapters on cholera telling my story, and on anthrax, where I really did play a significant role in tracking down the perpetrator of the anthrax bioterrorist event. So I have a kind of mixed emotion about the book, but I'm glad that it serves a really good purpose now, because everybody seems to be very willing to listen, whereas 20 years ago, nobody listened. I think that's sort of the big difference.
Absolutely. I'm wondering if maybe then, before we get into some of the kind of social political concepts in the book, that we can take a step back and, you know, before speaking up about these issues, before even your work as the director of the National Science Foundation, let's kind of go back to the beginning, and maybe we can talk a little bit about what got you into science when you first, found that spark.
I think what really intrigued me about science and made it a kind of career goal is that I grew up in a small town in Massachusetts, north of Boston, really literally a block from the lighthouse in Beverly Cove, Massachusetts, which meant that during the summers I could wander the beach. My dog and I could hike the rocks and wander along the beach. I was intrigued by nature in general. We also had very nice parks that we could spend time meandering around and getting used to wildflowers in the spring, changes in the weather patterns. The hurricane was fascinating that hit the coast of Massachusetts when I was a kid. These were kind of general experiences. But then my sister, who is an artist, married a physicist who would come to the house with his physics friends. And it was intriguing and fascinating listening to them talk about their research and their travels, the things they did. That was very, very appealing. I decided I'd like to be a chemist. Well, when I mentioned that to the chemistry teacher in my high school, his response was, "Girls don't do chemistry." But he probably was right, because at that time, I think the number of women chemists who were actually faculty members at universities could be counted in one hand, or maybe two hands at the most. Mm-hmm. So in a way, it turns out that chemistry, like engineering, has been a hard barrier to overcome, to become a chemist. So when I decided to go on to college, I applied to women's colleges because at that time, women couldn't go to Harvard. They could go to Radcliffe, but they couldn't use the library, only men. And Princeton was male. Georgetown was male. It was pretty much, the Ivies were pretty much restricted to boys attending college. So I applied to.
And did you have any sense of, you know, indignancy around that? Or was it really, it was so baked into the culture and into the society that it's like, well, girls go to women's colleges if they want to get a proper education.
Maybe that was what the general feeling was, but for me, it was resentment,
mm-hmm.
deep resentment, because I really wanted to go to a very good school. I did get accepted to Radcliffe, and I got accepted at some other women's colleges, Smith, but then I would have had to commute. I didn't, the scholarships that I got didn't pay the full tuition. I would have had to work my way through and then commute on the train from Beverly to Boston, which is a half-hour ride. We used to call it was the Boston and Maine Railroad, but we used to call it the Broken and Mended because it was always falling apart. I got my sister got a job teaching art at Purdue, where her husband was a Fulbright scholar in physics. So mm-hmm. she said, why don't you apply to Purdue? I had never thought about it. Frankly, didn't even know what Purdue was or where it was. I applied and I got a complete scholarship, which meant that I could go to college, live on campus, be a regular student. So that was my choice. And I have had no regrets because the education I got was really what I needed. I ended up a scientist, and had I gone to Radcliffe, I probably would have ended up in women's studies, or not even women's studies, because that came later. I would have ended up in writing, creative writing, with perhaps pushed into a career working as a writer for a magazine. And it would have been okay, but I think what I really am doing, I love deeply. Here I am at an age that I should be retired, but I have no interest in retiring because it's too much fun doing the science, working with students, writing papers. I wouldn't want to give it up.
So you're still actively working, doing you know, research, mentoring, and writing in your eighth decade of life?
Yes.
Wow.
Yes. Yes, I am writing, in fact, this past year, probably a half a dozen manuscripts have been published. Data that had been accumulated, data that's being accumulated. And I have my 64th PhD student ready to graduate in another year.
64,
they've all
it's incredible.
Done very well. Yeah, they've all done very well. And I'm very proud of them. They're all over the world. Yeah, and a good number of them, maybe half, were women, which, again, is unusual.
Absolutely. And I know that I'm kind of going out of left field here, but I promise I'll return simply because this is an area of my own interest. I'm working on my PhD right now in existential psychotherapy or existential psychology. And so I do psychotherapy in that area. I hope you don't mind my asking, only because it says it on your Wikipedia page, 86 years old, still actively focused in the science. I'm wondering how much of kind of life review, how much of, you know, getting older has this sort of reflection become important to you, and the importance of sort of telling your story to others as you now have the hindsight that you might not have had a few decades ago.
I enjoy talking with students about my career because I've had a wonderful life. In fact, the book kind of is cut short. I should have had two more chapters, a chapter on oceanography and the work I had done, because I was one of the top 20 most frequent users of the research vessel, the Eastward, out of North Carolina. And we did a lot of work doing analyses of microorganisms in the Puerto Rico Trench, very deep part of the ocean. And then another chapter should have been on international collaborations, because I was president of a couple of international societies, and I continue to telephone and collaborate and write papers with my colleagues in Montpellier, France, in Brest, France, with colleagues in Japan, Singapore, Latin America. I have students all over the world. In fact, my first trip overseas was really to Japan in 1968, which was fascinating because it was at a time when the dress and customs were still quite traditional. It was not unusual to see almost all the men and women at the train station dressed in the typical Japanese dress of the time. Now, of course, you wouldn't be able to differentiate Tokyo Station from New York Grand Central or Penn Station, because dress, habits, so forth, have all become rather uniform around the world, really.
Right. Yeah. But a lot has changed.
Indeed. But I really find it irritating that I can't do as much as I would like. For example, I was an avid jogger. Now I can walk. And so on Sunday with my friend that comes over and we go walking, we did a 7-mile hike. That was great. But I would have run several 7 miles 20 years ago. So that's the one difference that is kind of irritating and annoying. But otherwise, I travel. I do what I like. My children, I have two daughters. They're wonderful to visit. And finally, now that I've gotten my COVID vaccination, I have booked a flight in May to California to visit my daughter, who's at the University of California, Davis. She's the curator of the botanical herbarium. And I haven't seen her for over a year, so that's going to be great fun. She and her husband live in Sacramento.
Oh, I love to see multi-generational respect and excitement about academia and about academics that's not necessarily prescribed. You know, I have a lot of friends who are physicists or neuroscientists, and there's often this mentality that my kid's going to also do exactly what I do. And I think it's a rude awakening when they realize that their kids are like, oh no, I'm definitely not going to be a physicist growing up with you.
Well, it was kind of interesting. My husband and I, when we raised our kids, we told them when they were going off to college, look, we said, we'll pay for everything, but you owe us this one thing you have to do. You can major in whatever you like, but you have to take math through calculus and chemistry through organic. That's all you own us. The rest is yours. And so my youngest daughter decided she would be a social scientist, a social worker. And she spent a summer after graduating with the Frontier Nursing Service in Kentucky. And she called us just before Christmas and said, I'm going to med school. And I said, great. So she had the coursework she needed.
Yeah, go OCHEM.
That's right. So she went off to medical school to a great program, which was an MD PhD program that allowed her to do a non-science PhD. In fact, the group that at the University of Illinois, it was a select group of about 16 to 20 students who were expected to do non-science PhDs to make them sort of, I guess, humanitarian physicians. So she did her PhD in medical history and spent time in Tanzania in Africa working on women's health historically from 1850 to the present, and then postdoc at the Harvard School of Public Health. And now she practices medicine in Canada. And my other daughter was very artistic, but ended up really enjoying horticulture and gardening. And so she's a botanist, and now she's a California wildflower expert.
I love that so much. That's incredible. And of course, your first love, as you mentioned, was chemistry. And throughout your kind of your research endeavors, you discovered microbiology, you discovered these other passions. Can you maybe tell us a little bit about that journey, about how you found your interests and where you decided to kind of focus your attention?
I started out at Purdue University majoring in chemistry, but the classes were huge, and you practically needed a binocular if you came to class late, because you'd be way up in the back of the auditorium and you'd barely see the blackboard. The way it was taught was pretty strongly agricultural.
Oh, okay.
It wasn't really intriguing for me. And so I kind of meandered through taking courses in literature, took a course in playwriting, poetry. It was just fun. And then I had a roommate who was off to medical school. She turned out to be a very successful pediatric ophthalmologist, and she too has had a career doing surgery overseas, working on children in places like Nigeria and Nepal and so forth. Anyway, about my junior year, as I was going from one idea about majoring to another, suggested to me that I should take this course in bacteriology from Dr. Dorothy Powelson. I took the course, and that was it, because I was just totally fascinated by seeing these little critters under the microscope darting here and there. So that kind of gelled it. And I did apply to medical school, but was accepted. At the time, I really didn't understand or realize or didn't know that getting into medical school was tough, and for women was even tougher, because at the time, probably 2-3% of the students in medical schools, which were 100, 200 student medical schools in a given class, would be women. And I was accepted to all three that I applied to. I was getting ready to go to medical school. It was March in my senior year, and graduation was in June. And I went out on a blind date with a very handsome graduate student, and we were married 2 months later. So he had just come back from serving in the Army, and I didn't want him to lose the year of graduate school. So we agreed that he would apply where he would be wanted to go, then I would go to medical school there. So he was accepted at the University of Washington, which was exactly where he wanted to go. I applied to the medical school at the University of Washington. I was accepted, but I got another letter saying you have to be a legal resident of the Pacific Northwest to be accepted, which meant I would have to wait a year, live in the Northwest, then reapply. Otherwise, I could go to graduate school at the University of Washington, and I was accepted into the microbiology department. So that's how I ended up in microbiology. And then It got a little complicated, because when I arrived at the University of Washington, little did I know, the advisor for the new graduate students was Dr. Howard Douglas. He was an enologist from University of California, Davis, interestingly. And when he asked me what I'd like to do, I said, well, I'd been advised to work with Dr. Herschel Roman to do genetics. Well, that was the worst thing I could have said, because I didn't know it, but he and Dr. Roman hated each other. So it was the worst thing I could have said. I did go up to see Dr. Roman, and he did accept me to do genetics, but he really didn't like women students. That was pretty obvious. And so he made it kind of difficult for me and the only other woman in his lab who was his technician. So I decided after a year that that wasn't going to work. And I was again cast out, wondering what I'm going to do with my life. So I turned again to literature. There were some really super English professors at the University of Washington at the time. So I took some more English courses. But then I learned that there was a new professor in oceanography who was teaching marine microbiology. That sounded very interesting. So I talked to him. He needed a technician. And so I applied for the job and I helped him set up his lab. And at the end of one semester, he said, you really ought to be the grad student. So that's how I ended up doing marine microbiology, which is fascinating again, because at that time, there were probably five marine microbiologists in the whole world and none in the United States. So I ended up being trained officially as a marine microbiologist. And now that's a very hot area of study.
It's incredible because two kind of, I guess, personality traits, features stick out to me as you're telling me these stories. One is openness, this openness to accept opportunity, to maybe shift gears, to say, I don't know, that sounds interesting. Let's try it for a while. And two, the resiliency of you know, being shut down, closed out, no, you can't come here. Or if you do, I'm going to make your life miserable in the process, and saying, okay, I don't have to stay. I can try something new. I can pick myself back up and I can keep pushing. I mean, those are traits that seem like they were fundamental and probably necessary for women scientists for, you know, as far back as we know.
Certainly at that time, for sure, and earlier. I was just determined to become a professional person, either a PhD or an MD. I would like to have gone to medical school because it would have helped me in my work in Bangladesh. But it wasn't that much of an impediment because I could really do what I wanted to do. I did work in the hospitals in Bangladesh, not treating patients, but working, doing research on cholera. I think ultimately I probably have had more of an influence and a positive effect on human health than I would have had as a physician, working in a way that affected many, many people. For example, the work that we did on discovering the origin of cholera, the bacterium, being a naturally occurring bacterium in the environment. It was believed to be a bacterium transmitted person to person. But we isolated it in the work we did in Seattle on marine bacteria, and then the work in the Chesapeake Bay, we isolated it from the Chesapeake Bay, where we didn't have cholera, hadn't had cholera for 100 years. It was disbelieved. And that, again, was where being a woman was difficult, because if I'd been a man, they would have said, wow, terrific, discovery, prizes here and there. Whereas being a woman, they didn't believe me. They said it was nonsense, couldn't be true, wasn't good science, which is why I published so much, because I just kept publishing the findings in peer-reviewed journals where, you know, you got pretty stiff review and criticism. In fact, one of the papers that I have the most highest number of citations is a paper that I was rejected from Science magazine, and I had to publish it in another peer-reviewed journal, but not, you know, a first-tier journal, but a good journal.
Right. Right.
So that was the sort of thing you had to put up with.
With the Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, no, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
And isn't it just the greatest irony that still to this day, there you see a mentality, a sexist mentality, a racist mentality, that individuals who are women, who are ethnic minorities, who are other disenfranchised groups, are somehow less capable, are somehow lazier, are somehow less able, when really what's actually happening is that we individuals are having to push harder, prove ourselves more, do 10 times as much for the same amount of credit.
Indeed. In fact, my advice when I'm asked, and I am asked almost every time I do give a lecture, what advice do you give for young women? And my strongest advice is get a posse.
Mm.
Get yourself a posse. Meaning, join up with women who are doing science, engineering, medicine, mathematics, the non-traditional for women careers or for minorities. Have lunch, have coffee, meet, you know, every couple of weeks and share your experiences. And I think finding that you're not alone, that it's the system. It's not you. There's nothing wrong with you. You're bright, you're smart, you've got brains, you can do it. It's just that you're beaten down, and if you let them beat you down, then you will lose. Otherwise, you can win. So that's my advice.
I love that. And you know, when you were talking about the cholera research that you did, such a beautiful kind of prime example of an experience where no matter what you do or say, no matter how evidence you have to support your findings, you're kind of not heard, not respected, not listened to. So you have to work 10 times as hard. I'm wondering, sort of on the flip side of that, can you speak to any experience as a woman having a particular perspective, being a voice within the milieu that was not a common voice, that allowed you to kind of bring in something that was missing from the field or from the practice? You know, was your perspective fundamentally unique?
No, I don't think my perspective was unique, because as I wrote my story,
mm-hmm.
it became clear that there were many, many women who had gone through the same sort of experiences. Mansplaining, for example, it's a universal phenomenon in the sense that at meetings, I would make a suggestion, you know, in the course of conversation, there'd be a silence, brief pause, and then the conversation would continue. And then a man would make the same suggestion, and everybody would say, you know, that's a really good idea. We should follow up on that. So I learned how to use that to my advantage. Because particularly when I was chairing meetings, and when I'm chairman, I can follow the discussion, allow the discussion to take its course, see where an action should be made, suggest the action, and then let the conversation move. And sure enough, a guy will pick up what suggestion that I had made, and then I can say, you know, that's a good idea. Let's have an act. Let's act on it. And so I can get the meeting moved. And so in a way, I can really control the outcome. When I say control, I mean that in a gentle sort of way, not with a hammer. But you can get a lot done.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, it sort of reminds me of this implicit or this unspoken, which I think we will now make explicit and make spoken, experience of a woman in modern society, where the navigation of ego, the utilization of certain types of sexist experiences, kind of trying to turn these things on their ear, use them to the advantage, figure out how to kind of make lemonade out of lemons. It's such a almost innate skill that we have as women that when we start to talk about it with our male allies, for example, oftentimes their experiences are you kidding me? Like, are you that's what every day is like for you?
Yes, yes, indeed, indeed, and I think the fact that we are able to direct, I don't want to say manipulate, because that's not really it, because that means you're in control, and you're really not in control. So what we're doing is from really practically birth, from being a toddler, mm-hmm. is finding out that the way you get done what you need to get done is through an indirect, around the corner, rather than a direct head-on. And I noticed this really between male and female graduate students. The women come in to the lab and ask permission. May I use the pH meter? May I use the scintillation counter? May I use the whatever? The men come in and just say, out of my way, it's my turn, and I need the machine, and you let me do it. You let me have at it. So it's a kind of entitlement that comes with the male psyche, and the permission requesting in the female psyche.
And of course, there's nothing intrinsic to being a man or being a woman that presupposes this. This is completely learned behavior from the time we're children. It's reinforced that women ask and women, you know, do things politely, and women manage everybody's ego, and they you know, massage the situation and keep the peace. And that men are, like you said, entitled, and that they, if they speak a little bit louder or they use a little bit more force, that people will give them what they need. And it works, which is why it keeps on happening.
Well, as a student of psychology, what is your perspective on this?
I mean, that's really it. I think that ultimately we see now, especially with younger generations that are so open, utilizing these great internet tools that allow them to share their perspective in a sort of non-judgmental way, that the gender binary has become less entrenched, that we have more, you know, trans individuals coming out. We have more non-binary individuals coming out, that we're seeing that kind of gender identity is more fluid. And I think really what that is that the younger generation is, quote unquote, allowed by society to be who they really are. They're willing to push back against those societal constraints. And if we all were able to do that, I don't think we would have these entrenched gender roles. Those things are just reinforced by our parents, by our churches, by our educational institutions. I mean, as you mentioned, you're facing this stuff throughout your career with institutes of higher learning, which should be the most progressive, the most liberal places for knowledge, and yet they're entrenched.
When things become ossified, that's what happens. I think that's the problem.
Yeah.
And I find it intriguing as a biologist. It's perfectly natural that there should be this gradient in sexuality, as in everything else in life.
Yeah.
Being a systematist, an evolutionary biologist or a microbiologist, it's very clear that species demarcation is not clear-cut and rigid. It melds into the next related species, not with walls between species X and species Y.
Yeah, this kind of taxonomic drive, this categorization drive that we have as human beings is a construct. We bucket things because it helps us make sense of the world, but those things don't, I guess, have intrinsic buckets within them. I think I had Lulu Miller on the show several months ago, and she wrote a stunning book called Why Fish Don't Exist, which is, yes, a story about an individual person, a taxonomist, but also more deeply a real kind of, maybe not indictment, but a questioning of these, quote, natural orders and these natural categories that really we make sense of the world based on our own culture, based on societal influence. We make sense of the world based on what's in fashion.
Well, we live in a three-dimensional world. There's a book that was published many years ago called Point Land, and it describes the psychology of living in one dimension as opposed to two dimensions and three dimensions, and being unable to communicate amongst those who live in the different ordered societies. So if you live in three dimensions, you don't really understand the life of a one-dimensional society, which makes one ask the question, is there a fourth dimension that we are unaware of that is observing us in our three-dimensional world?
Yeah.
Interesting question.
Absolutely. And one that, yeah, really the kind of metacognition required to muse philosophically about this, you know, will I ever know? Could I even know? And do I need to be open to that possibility as well? It is fascinating. You know, I think about such an incredible career. I think about the discoveries within the cholera research, within the anthrax research, also the leadership positions that you've held. I'm wondering, you know, and I don't even know how to ask this question in a pointed way, but your experience as a truly trailblazing woman in these areas, holding high levels of kind of leadership, of authority, was there just a lot of backlash for you? Was there, it's one thing to be fighting your way through getting a degree or fighting your way through a publication, getting recognition for your own work. But then once you're in a position where you're like, okay, now I might have a little bit of power or a little bit of authority, and people are like, I don't want you there as a woman. That's not your place. Was that the experience that you had?
I think not.
Okay.
And I think because I really was not really aggressive. I wasn't overbearing. And therefore, in retrospect, perhaps I was disarming in the sense that the view was that I was not exactly a pushover, but I was just a nuisance in the way. But I really knew what I wanted to get done.
Yeah.
Hence, I could get it done. And for that reason, thinking back now, I really didn't have pushback at the National Science Foundation. I had a wonderful experience. I came to the foundation, however, with an agenda. I knew really what I wanted to accomplish. I knew that funding was important, especially doubling the graduate stipend because it was much too low. And having had the experience of working in the halls of the legislature in Annapolis for the state of Maryland, I had been essentially trained or cut my teeth on how you work with legislators. And clearly, you're not exactly obsequious, but you really aren't dramatically aggressive.
Right.
And so I could get done what I really wanted to get done. In fact, I accomplished, in retrospect, quite a lot. I doubled the graduate stipend, and that was kind of amusing because what I did was start a new program for graduate students called the GK-12 program, the graduate K-12 program. Essentially, what the program was that the graduate student, instead of spending 20 hours a week working as the major domo for the professor, making the reagents for the lab or organizing the lab and teaching the lab, instead, the student would be under the direction of his or her professor, be working with a teacher in elementary, middle, or high school, and spend the 20 hours a week teaching.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
In the high school and developing the experiments and so forth, because the generally speaking, the teachers in the elementary school either are afraid of science or haven't been trained in science or don't like science. And this is one way to bring science in through someone who loves what they're doing and has excitement and so forth. Anyway, I was able to establish a $30,000 a year stipend. And of course, I knew exactly what would happen. The Ivies, particularly the presidents, would go berserk that the revered National Science Foundation graduate fellowship was only half of this other program. So I said, my goodness, why don't you go to Congress and suggest to the Congress they should double the stipend, which they did and which happened.
Brilliant.
So the graduate stipend for the graduate fellowships at the National Science that the National Science Foundation funded was doubled.
Oh, what a brilliant kind of example of what we were just talking about, of sort of navigating egos navigating, you know, all these different kind of agenda-driven things, the loud voices in the room to sort of under the radar make sure that your goals were accomplished. You know, I wonder, though, at the same time, this kind of skill, again, that many of us women have developed, what the kind of negative consequences that we have to deal with oftentimes is the internalization or the quiet time that we spend at home processing the microaggressions, processing the sometimes more pernicious, almost below the radar sexism that we experience. And so I'm wondering if you have any sort of advice for individuals who are still facing, you know, not the obvious point to this guy and call HR and can you believe what they said to me? I've just recorded it and it's, you know, beyond the pale. But the under the radar, I can't quite put my finger on it, but I don't feel safe. I don't feel comfortable. I somehow feel like I'm being gaslit into thinking I'm just not good enough. That kind of stuff that we deal with still to this day.
But again, that's where having a posse helps.
Yeah.
Going out to meet with a group of like-minded individuals, that is, in a sense, experiencing the same put-downs, the same sexist comments or even the imposter syndrome, which apparently is fairly common, and having the kind of friendship where you can say, you know, I sometimes think I really am not good enough to do this. We all think that. And to be told, hey, wait a minute, if there's anybody that's good enough, it's you. Your friends will be able to provide that extra dimensional perspective, which is why having this posse really helps.
Yeah.
I'm very envious of my medical doctor daughter who, having gone through this program where there were 8 women in this, I think 16 or 20 person program, they became very much their own posse. And they, years later, they still get together once a year and share experiences of practice wherever they may be. One's a surgeon, another is a general practitioner, another is out of work because of the change in the medical strictures today, the health system being so broken. So I think the posse is an important solution. It's not the only one, but it's a way to verify your strengths.
I agree. You know, I found that that has been really, really not just helpful, but invaluable in my own life and my own growth throughout academia, is to have strong women friends who we support each other, we care for each other, we look out for each other's mental health. We make sure that we intervene if and when we notice that somebody's self-efficacy is poor, or they are being gaslighted, they're really starting to question their sanity a little bit. One of the things that I noticed too is that institutionally, if you find yourself in the unlucky, you know, situation of being, let's say, one of 2 women in your lab group, or one of, you know, 2 women in a board meeting, heaven forbid you're the only one, because then things get really hairy. But when there's at least one other woman or gender minority present, we can empower each other's voices. You mentioned that idea of mansplaining. You know, we can say, I just heard, you know, Alicia say this, and I think that that's a good idea. Elevate that voice, because men may not do it with you or for you in that situation. And that can help, oh my gosh, leaps and bounds to just have a partner in crime. I think one of the things that's been really sad throughout kind of this history is that society has sort of reinforced to us women that there are only so many slots, so we should be in competition with one another, as opposed to women have to fight for each other so that we can make there be more slots. We need to be on each other's teams and help one another.
Well, it's delightful that today 51 or 52% of the medical students are women.
Mm-hmm.
In an entering class. And I think that is a big step from the 2 or 3% when I was a student.
It's incredible.
30 or 40 years ago. So there have been changes. What I really feel very good about is the outspokenness today. Things are being said openly that need to be said and were definitely not 40 years ago. You simply just swallowed it and moved on. And
right. The ramifications still exist today, but there are strength in numbers. And it's almost become unfashionable that if I were to stand up and say, this happened to me, this was my experience, that it would be career suicide. What's more common is that it actually points to the perpetrators. And hopefully there's at least some accountability there. Not always, but moving in that direction.
Progress can be glacially slow, but it does move.
And you, of course, have this incredible perspective to be able to say, you know, in the 60s, I saw it this way. In the 80s, I saw it this way. In the 2000s, it was this way. And now we're in the 2020s. Like that hindsight being 2020, we don't see ourselves age in the mirror, but we can look now and say, wow, I do look different than I did 20 years ago. It's the same thing with this kind of progress. Well, Rita, I'm wondering, I close my episodes by asking my same guests two big picture questions. But before I ask those questions, I'm just wondering, is there anything else that we didn't, obviously there's so much we didn't get to, but is there anything, any advice that you have on the tip of your tongue or any other kind of concepts or issues that you were hoping we would have been able to discuss today?
Well, I think another point I'd like to make is that you need balance in your life. I was very fortunate in that my husband and I were a team. We raced sailboats. He was a very, very good sailor. And so it was a two-person dinghy that we raced. And he was skipper and I was crew. We did a lot of camping and hiking and a lot of things that would take the sting off some of these insults and slurs and slings that we've been discussing. And I think that's really very important. You do need to have a safe place to go to in your life.
Oh, absolutely. And a life outside of academia. You're so right. Well, Rita, you know, I ask my guests these two big picture questions, and I think more than anybody I've had on the show, I am really, really excited to hear what you have to say. Now, they're sort of broad, so keep that in mind and take all the time that you need. But what I would love to know from you is, when you look to the future, in whatever context is relevant to you personally, so this could be your own life, it could be familial, it could be academic or global, even cosmic. Number one, what is the thing that really is keeping you up the most at night, the thing you're most concerned about, maybe even kind of pessimistic or even cynical about? But on the flip side of that, so we can end on a positive note, number two, what are you genuinely, you know, really authentically optimistic about? What are you looking forward to?
I'm really, really concerned about climate change and the lack of attention to it. It is very, very real. It is very, very dangerous. It really threatens humanity, our civilization. When having had the opportunity to travel a dozen times to the South Pole and having been able to go to the North Pole in a nuclear submarine as director, I've been able to see the parts of the world that are really under tremendous threat, which in turn means tremendous threat to us as human beings. It's genuinely real. It's quite frightening because it's not something that you can close the door or lock the windows or somehow protect yourself from it. It's global, and it affects all societies and all humans. And I really worry that we may be writing the last chapter of humanity. That sounds terribly drastic, but it's an answer to your question.
Yeah, no, and it's, I mean, we need to be drastic. That's the point, right? I think so often we are comforted by avoiding eschatological or existential questions like this. But the truth is we have to confront them. Otherwise, we're going to just stall and we're going to be crippled by inaction. And as we see, that's biting us in the ass right now. You know, on the flip side of that, I'm wondering, where are you seeing a lot of hope? What's kind of on the horizon that you truly are looking forward to?
I think we are making fantastic advances in science. And I do think that the more we really learn the facts of existence and how our world operates, and the exploration to other planets probably is a good idea, because we may find remnants of previous life, maybe civilization, and that'll be a reckoning that will be positive. So I'm excited about the work that I'm doing now, using satellite sensing to predict infectious disease, understanding by sequencing the genomes of microorganisms, understanding how they very intricately keep us well and protect us from disease, pathogens, as well as producing compounds that are absorbed in our tissues and in our, as much as far as to our brain, and making us feel better. So I think we're with the kind of positive aspects of artificial intelligence, which is really just pattern discerning on a highly elegant scale, that we're also learning how the brain works. And I think that's the biggest challenge of all. I suspect you would agree.
Absolutely. Yeah. People can't see the big smile that's been developing on my face. Well, everyone, the book is A Lab of One's Own, One Woman's Personal Journey Through Sexism in Science, by the former director of the National Science Foundation, among other incredible achievements, Dr. Rita Colwell. Rita, thank you so much for being here today. I've learned an awful lot from you. It's been really inspiring as well. And I feel really motivated now.
It's been a pleasure. It's been a real pleasure talking with you. I've enjoyed it.
And everybody listening, thank you for coming back week after week. I'm really looking forward to the next time we all get together to talk nerdy.
Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on ChumbaCasino.com. I looked over the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Coincidence? I think not. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere, even at 30,000 feet. So sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's ChumbaCasino.com, and live the Chumba life.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.